Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations.
From Tokyo, Japan, I'm Chris Lamont here with Medlier Memma, who is joining us from the United States. And I would also like to welcome to the show Dr. Ingo Bodie, who is joining us from Denmark. This is truly going to be a global conversation traversing many time zones, and it looks like we've pulled it off without having anyone join us too late or from too late or too early of an hour. Medlier, I guess that's still the case for you, right?
Yeah, a little bit, but nothing I can't handle.
And Ingvild, I understand it's morning over there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So I have to say, we are delighted to have Ingvild with us. Ingvild brings to the show an impressive expertise in weaponized artificial intelligence. Ingvild is Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern Denmark, and is also the principal investigator of an ERC research project on autonomous weapon systems and international norms, or AutoNorms, the AutoNorms project, which we'll ask you about in a little bit. But just to get us started, because I'm in Tokyo, and we started this podcast in Tokyo, I understand you were once a postdoc here in Japan. Can you tell us just a little bit more about how you got to Japan?
Of course. So, first of all, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for asking me about Tokyo, because I always like talking about Japan. So I came there actually as a postdoc funded by the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science. So back then, the JSPS, as it's abbreviated, had this program at the UN University in Tokyo that they would offer 2-year postdocs that you could apply through via UNU. And I had been in my PhD, actually, I came from a completely different research area. So I had been studying the influence that individuals can have on policy processes or processes of policy change in the UN system. So that's what attracted me to pursue this kind of research for 2 years at UNU, kind of within the context of the UN system itself. So that's how I came to apply for the postdoc, and then very luckily was offered it. And it was a really nice time for me, spending it in Tokyo and just being allowed to just focus on your postdoc, on your project for 2 years, you know, which I think in our busy academic lives, we never have that opportunity again. I kind of thought when I started my current ERC project that this would be a bit like that, but it turns out it's of course not like that at all, because now I'm in charge of a team of 4 researchers, and the scale of it is on a completely different level than my postdoc.
Certainly postdocs are fond memories in terms of having a lot more time to focus on research. We'll probably get back to Japan in a couple seconds, but I know Medlier has a question that he would like to ask you. So I'll hand over to my colleague.
Yeah, well, the question I guess I have, and you have written on this, so this is not going to be out of left field here, but it's with regards to the ongoing conflict in Russia, between Russia and Ukraine. I think you've pointed this out, others have pointed this out, that there is this sense that this war is being fought in a very kind of traditional way, infantry or, kind of almost like World War II type of warfare. But you've pointed out, I think rightly, and others have also pointed out that, there is actually a lot more going on underneath or behind the computer screens or above, above ground with regards to the utilization of AI. What have you uncovered with regards to that?
Yeah, I mean, my particular focus in military AI is really weaponized AI. So I'm interested in the extent to which AI has become integrated in weapon systems of various types, and to what extent these systems have been used in the Russia-Ukraine war as well has also been of interest to me. So, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in pointing out that there's a lot underneath the surface, and I think there's even more in terms of decision-making support systems, and of course in the area of cyber. But in the area of weapon systems, we actually also see quite a lot happening, in particular in relation to loitering munitions. So these are systems that have the capacity to actually use force autonomously. Currently, the systems that are being used in the Ukraine-Russian war are supposedly still under human control. So the manufacturers are very careful to point out that there is a human in the loop, right? But we also know from previous publications of the same manufacturers that these systems are in fact capable of applying force autonomously. So there is always this gray zone with these kind of systems that we as observers can never be sure in what kind of mode have they been used. But what we know is that Russia has a number of these loitering munition systems that have appeared in Ukraine, and there are There's photographic evidence showing that these systems have been used, such as the KUB BLA system or the Lancet. And on the Ukrainian side, the US has supplied Switchblade 300s mostly and the Phoenix Ghost drones, which are the systems vary a bit in terms of their loitering time, so how long they can stay in air, what the kind of their radius is, but their functionality is very similar. There is a lot of focus on the conventional ways in which the war has been fought, and I think that is completely right, because we have been maybe a bit too enamored by this Russian modernization, military modernization narrative, right? So which is a narrative that they put out, but the extent to which this is really coming to play is limited, I think. But we still see the more kind of normalizing use of these systems, right? So, and that is for me the important bit about the Russia-Ukrainian war, so that that it seems to become more normal, right, to use AI-driven systems in warfare. And it's not even, some news media reports on it, but it's not even headline news anymore, right? So, and I think that for me is the important development.
And this goes hand in hand with your research in Autonorms, which I think is a fantastic name for a project, by the way. So it's great. And well done, all of you, on coming up with that. But it's exactly this kind of concern, and that's where this evolution of normative kind of views on the use or non-use, or in a way seeing these drones, loitering drones that were used, my understanding perhaps maybe could have been used in Libya, and now of course in the Nagorno-Karabakh also conflict not too long ago. Turkey has been a big provider of this. So we've seen this slow evolution of this. Where were they? Were they not? There was some ambiguity about their use. And now in Russia, or with regards to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, we know they have been used. It's just a question of to what degree they're autonomous or not, right? Or to what degree, how long have been loitering on their own. And the non-reaction, so to speak, the lack of reaction by anyone, should be concerning. I mean, my understanding, at least from my reading literature with regards to nuclear weapons, is, you know, this taboo of non-use is in a way what has been protecting us from the use of nuclear weapons, and that taboo seems to not be there at all when it comes to drones, yeah. And other kind. And by drones, I mean the kinds of drones we're talking about are not the ones that are, you know, controlled by a video game controller somewhere in a bunker, but actually, as you point out, loitering, they have some autonomous capacities.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. So I think that there is a trajectory of these systems having been used, as you said, in most of the conflicts that made headlines in the last 4 or 5 years, right? So kind of already starting in Syria, then Libya, Nagorno-Karabakh, and now also in Ukraine. So I think there is a build-up of this. But I would also think that although quite often, I've also been following the diplomatic process on autonomous weapon systems that is happening in Geneva, has been happening since 2014, but since 2017, it's been a bit more formalized, right, in the form of the group of governmental experts. And what I always found curious at this process is that, first of all, the problem is very much pushed to the future, right? So autonomous weapon systems are still portrayed as a problem of the future. So in the sense that, okay, they're not there yet, yeah, we might have to do something to preempt this from happening. While all the way, there have always been these systems, such as loitering munitions, that already have autonomous features in their targeting functions, you know. So munitions such as the Harpy or the Harop, the Israeli manufacturing system, have been around for much longer, right? And the Harop is the manufacturers are pretty clear that this is a fully autonomous system, targeting radars, right? So I guess that's why maybe it went a bit below the radar, as it were, but because it's not targeting personnel, right? So which is also the difference to the loitering munitions that we see in use in Ukraine. But at the same time, these systems have these autonomous functionalities, right? So and again, these are not the only ones. So you also have air defense systems, which of course have been operational since the 1960s, which include autonomous features and targeting. You have counter drone systems, you have active protection systems. So all of these weapon systems have been for years and years integrating more and more of these automated or autonomous or AI driven functions. No matter, it's like the terminology changes, right? But the functionality kind of is the same, right? And they, I think, And this is kind of the trajectory we should be looking at, you know. So it's not something that can be pushed to the future or even just happening now, you know, but something that has actually been happening incrementally for a very long time. And only now, maybe it's beginning to be perceived more of as more of a problem, right? But even that is limited, right? As you pointed out, because the discussion about the extent to which these systems are actually an appropriate way of using force is still very limited, I would say.
Definitely. One thing I wanted to just highlight there when you mentioned the normalization of autonomous weapon systems was the 2023 defense budget request from Japan's Ministry of Defense, which just kind of threw in there a request for an attack drone, right? Which would have, one point in time would have seemed shocking, right? This seems like it's describing an autonomous weapon system of some kind, and it's kind of there in a defense budget request. Which brings me to that second thing that you were talking about, was kind of this technology has been around for a long time. And I wonder to what extent we have really grappled with the I guess the negative features of this technology. And think about, you mentioned missile defense systems. I think there was a piece kind of about a few years back in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which talked about an incident with the Patriot missile system in 2003, which misidentified a British aircraft, shot it down and killed the British crew. But the problem was in part that there was a change in culture in the crews that were operating these missile batteries, right? It went from people who had a knowledge of how these systems operated and how they identified targets to people who were just kind of there to kind of point and click, yeah. Right? And as with a lot of these systems, as they become more complex, the need for greater technological expertise, you would assume, would grow exponentially if you're going to actually have people who would be able to understand. I mean, it's not just having a human in a loop, it's having a human that hopefully understands how this system is operating and is able to identify when it's misidentifying targets or it's not operating the way it was intended. And when you think about that and the costs associated with that, is there going to be kind of a cooling off of enthusiasm for some of these more complex systems as we go forward? Because it seems like, I mean, it doesn't offer the cost savings and the personnel savings that a lot of proponents of these technologies argue that they do.
Yeah, thank you for this question. I mean, unfortunately, I think there will not be the waning of enthusiasm. I see quite the contrary, you know. Yeah. So despite the problems that we see being raised by these systems, as you said, so the way that I've perceived the debate is that the human in the loop is kind of always pretended to be the fail-safe, yeah, the solution to any problems raised potentially by autonomy in weapon systems. And the extent to which that human in the loop is actually able, right, to meaningfully control the use of force is not really questioned to a great extent. I've actually looked at air defense systems in the past, so also studying the Patriot system in detail, but also and of course there was another incident of friendly fire. It was not just the British jet, but an American jet was also shot down by the Patriot in the same kind of time span, right? And what is curious about this incident is that what came out after in the independent investigations, right, is that as autonomy or more autonomy had been integrated into the Patriot, the training times for Patriot personnel were reduced, right? So, and this is kind of a typical fallacy of autonomous systems that you find a lot in human factor analysis, you know, so that there's this thinking, okay, the autonomous system will make the task of the human easier, right? But actually what it does is make the task more complex, right? So as you were saying, what we would actually need is a greater technical understanding of how the system functions and on what basis it also assigns targets. What basically algorithms are that it uses, right? And what are the potential false positives that the system might have? But none of this appeared to have happened in the case of the Patriot training. So there you also see this emphasized in the independent reports after these failures that the crews were more or less trained to trust the system, right? So there we also have this problematic incoming of automation bias, right, or automation complacency. That already, right? It's quite. Or we humans are quite inclined, right, to believe whatever outputs an automatic system puts forward to us, right? And then if you don't learn to kind of balance that trust with a healthy dose of mistrust, right, and actually have some additional information that allows you to distrust, right? So then I think we can get into a very complicated and challenging situation for these human operators. I think it's kind of curious, right? So even though we know more about what complex human-machine interaction really means for the human in the loop and the kind of challenges this puts the human operators under, what we're seeing is kind of going in a different direction and more or less kind of ignoring these complexities, I think. So also the way that these systems are talked about in Geneva, it is always kind of like, okay, these have a human in the loop, so we don't need to worry about that, right? So they're always this guarantor, but the extent of that guarantee is not really critically assessed or scrutinized.
Absolutely. If it shows you a green box, I mean, you're not going to question it. You might just click, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the problem is actually even more intense if we talk about loitering munitions, because here also that is the same system, right? So in a way that the human operator also has to approve a target prompted by the system. But then again, if the human operator is very close to war fighting, which in the case of these smaller loitering munitions usually is the case, are they really what is their critical mental space, right, to be able to make these kind of decisions and really deliberate, right? I mean, are they not just going to say, yes, okay, the system gives me this target, so it must be correct, right? So I think that's a major problem.
So just a question just on this ongoing issue of regulation that obviously your project centers on, or at least, you know, reflects on. There have been several meetings of the UN group of governmental experts on coming up with some kind of regulatory framework that seems to have just failed quite fantastically, at least by I think as an observer. I'm sure that the participants have different objectives. And so some people are turning inwards in a way. So in the United States, there is this emphasis on Directive 3000.09, which is actually DOD. It comes from the Pentagon. And it's meant to kind of outline conditions, or at least to outline a set of criteria that you have to kind of submit any weapon systems to for monitoring and control. Is that the direction we're going in the absence of any kind of overarching framework, that every country will end up developing their own kind of frameworks for this?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I would say that the process in Geneva, I mean, first of all, they never had a negotiation mandate, right? So the only mandate they ever had was to discuss. So, and they have failed for the last couple of years to decide whether they need a negotiation mandate, right? So whatever they can produce at the moment will only ever be kind of a soft law minimum quality. You know? And they came up with these 11 guiding principles on laws back in 2019. But these are very, very vague and ambiguous, right? So I think one of the principles says that they want to ensure human-machine interaction. But it's unclear what this exactly means and what kind of is the requisite quality of that. So it's a typical diplomatic document, right? But even more frustratingly, though, because it is just at this level of a recommendation, it doesn't have any legal status whatsoever, right? But it's the best that they produced in the last years. And now I think the move has been, so I was at the last meeting of the GGE in July of this year. The mood has been, as you were saying, also the US has been putting forward a sort of best practices document that tries to kind of set out a number of areas of consensus that have emerged in the last kind of years of discussion about the principles that should govern these systems, right? But these again would be purely voluntary. And the idea would be that that maybe a bit like the US directive, that countries would then kind of incorporate these systems into how their militaries assess the development or the use of autonomous weapon systems. But that group who put forward these kind of principles, so these also include Japan, the Republic of Korea, Australia, and Canada. So it's and the UK, I believe. So it's a group of kind of Western or industrialized countries who all have a certain interest, yeah, in developing and in using weapon system with autonomous features. You know, so I think, and that is also the general spirit of the document, I find, right? So that it's not about necessarily about regulation or not about prohibition at all, right? So it takes the stand that okay, we want to use these systems, and these systems can be beneficial, right, in warfare, not only for kind of military strategic reasons or tactical reasons, but also for humanitarian reasons, right? That's their pitch, right? But I think it doesn't really want to regulate, right? It just wants to set these kind of loose principles. And I think and many other states parties at the GGE are very opposed to these kind of soft forms of regulation, if you want to call it regulation even, right? So I think even that is contestable. So but at the same time, I think I think as an intermediate step, it's better to have this kind of document than to have nothing, because at the moment we literally have nothing that regulates this space. And that is, I think, getting more and more worrying and challenging. So I think it's good that states even if it's to a very limited degree, reflect on what it is they think is appropriate for them. Because at the moment, none of this is kind of written down or kind of put out there in some kind of discursive form. So we can just kind of piece together what states consider as appropriate by kind of looking at what they do, looking at their practices, right? So this is kind of the big argument that we make in autonoms, that at the moment the norms or kind of the understandings of what states consider to be appropriate are set in these practices, right?
So let me before, because I know Chris wants to turn the attention to our last topic for today, but I just can't, because, I mean, obviously this issue of autonorms and normative change, it brings to question also the role of NGOs. And we've had in our show here, also people have been involved with the campaign to ban killer robots. And of course, you engage with this constructivist literature that in a way embraces the role of NGOs in international diplomacy. How would you evaluate their efforts? I mean, what are the prospects that this, you know, NGO, this campaign, this network of NGOs as well as an activist actually may end up with an acceptable outcome for them?
Well, I mean, I think they are the reason, right? So NGOs are the reason that this topic is discussed in the first place. So I think that's very important to mention, right? So that without the efforts of the NGOs, this would not even be on the agenda of the UN. They were instrumental in putting it on the agenda of the Human Rights Council, where it started off, and then on bringing it over to the CCW, where it's discussed now. So I think that is a significant value added, right? And also they are bringing this kind of what I think is very interesting about the campaign to stop killer robots is they are campaigns. So it's not just a single NGO, it's not just Human Rights Watch, it's not just Amnesty, but they actually bring a number of NGOs from all over the world. You know, so it's not just a Western effort, right? So and you can see that by the delegates who are representing these NGOs. So they come from the Middle East, they come from Asia, right? So they come from Africa. And I think that is a very important signal, actually, right? So that this is not just a Western endeavor, right? So this is actually a global endeavor. So and it kind of shows that there are concerns around autonomous weapon systems. They are not restricted to one particular region of the world, but they are global concerns. That said, I think that they have run into a space at the moment at the GGE where they can't go any, they seem to not be able to go any further. And that is because some states are just really unwilling to compromise on any aspect. Of course, the Russian attitude now, since the invasion of Ukraine hasn't really helped the matter, right? It wasn't good last year. It's even worse this year, I think. So I think now what is potentially happening is that the potential of moving to a different forum, so a forum outside of the UN system. So what we've seen in the past with the Ottawa Convention, like the Landmine Convention, or with the Cluster Munitions Convention, so that what they would move out basically, right, to a separate forum that is then not bound by the consensus rules that the CCW is working under, because that is the real problem with the CCW discussions. That everything that the CCW says or kind of writes or publishes has to be supported by every single member state in the room. So if even a single one says they are not happy with a particular phrasing, then the whole thing is out. And that, of course, as you can imagine, is very limiting to the in the current state of affairs. So I think maybe this is what will happen, a move to another forum. And I think maybe this is at the moment the most likely, the best case scenario for us to get some kind of international legal treaty on autonomous weapons systems. So I can understand why they want to pursue this option, because it's not getting anywhere at the GGE, and it's getting terribly frustrating. If you spend a lot of effort in resources, right, in trying to get things moving, and it's never going anywhere for years and years, then I think it's maybe time to move. At the same time, the problem with that external process, of course, is that the big developers of the systems, such as the US, the UK, Russia, China, right? So all of these countries will not be part of such a process. I think they will not even be in the room, right? So because they're not interested in regulation.
Or they may be in the room so they can shape the conversation and then pull out the last moment, much like they did with the Rome Statute or other kinds of international negotiations.
I mean, that is that's right. So maybe they will be in the room, but they will not sign anything. So then we will have a document that will not be signed or ratified by some of the key developers of the technologies, which is problematic, I think. But at the same time, we would have a legal document, right? So that we could refer to, right? And that would set a standard. So I think that's still preferable. Yeah. I mean, there are a couple of things in terms of kind of tactics and strategies of NGOs. I mean, I'm not a humanitarian arms control campaigner, you know, so I don't, of course, can understand all of their reasonings, right? I personally find it a bit frustrating sometimes that they choose to very much also embrace this kind of future framing that states have been using, kind of saying that, okay, what we have to worry about are these fully autonomous weapon systems, right? That can function completely outside of human control, but they're not that much interested in looking at the quality of human control and some of the systems that we already have in use here. And I think maybe that's a strategic choice, right? To not kind of open too many boxes, right? And not to worry some of, and also keep states that are on their side actually, right? Because these air defense systems or missile defense systems are used by more than 90 states around the world. So kind of touching them, right? Or saying that we could potentially regulate them, I guess it's quite a big move. But I do think that these systems illustrate some of the challenges that we see then at a larger scale playing out when more and more autonomy is being integrated into weapon systems. So I think they should be part of the regulatory conversation.
And I think this brings us to kind of one of the last questions that we had, and that's to avoid a future framing, right? Not to think about this in terms of future wars, but kind of the present. How is automation transforming international conflict in the here and in the now? And you had, for example, the China flying drones over Taiwanese islands, doing things that are incredibly risky that you might not do with a human-operated aircraft. And also, it's a lot easier to shoot down a drone, right, in a way, psychologically. The barriers to using force against something that doesn't have a human operator in it. Both of that combined seems to set the stage for very dangerous escalatory encounters, right? Are these technologies making the world a lot more dangerous, a lot faster than we would like to admit?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you quite often see in literature this reference to fighting at machine speed, right, or war at machine speed, which is the whole reason that militaries want to integrate autonomous functions into weapon systems, because they make things faster, right? but that also comes, as you were saying, with distinct downsides, right? So if then decisions are made by the system in a split second, you know, or even now that the human operator may only have kind of 5 seconds or something to react, right? So that definitely reduces the potential of for humans to scrutinize potential targeting decisions, and especially if then on top of that you would think that we have a kind of a peer competitor conflict, right? So where both sides are using various types of AI driven systems, then also we're not entirely sure how the systems would interact with each other, right? I mean, so as I'm sure you've covered in your podcast before, right? So there are always limits to how far you can test an AI in any given scenario, right? So you will never be and completely sure how that AI is gonna react when it is deployed in reality, and how it is gonna interact with another AI that you don't really know everything about either, right? So So I think that it introduces a lot more unpredictability into how conflicts are being fought, right? And then I think also there's always this, for me, this kind of moral ethical dimension about what does this mean for the extent to which humans can remain in control over the use of force. Yeah, if they are asked to perform within the matter of a couple of seconds, right? And potentially not at all, right? Because they are perceived to be the weakest link. Okay, if the conversation about human control is at the moment going more in the direction that humans are also involved in the programming of these systems, right? So this is also a form of human control. And of course it is, because the humans set certain parameters, right? But just because humans programmed all kinds of AI systems, it doesn't mean that you then have control over how these systems are actually functioning, right, in the real world. So I think there are all kinds of kind of potential slippery slopes, and really challenges that are not being completely thought through. And kind of, and I feel that in the space that we are at the moment with the Russia-Ukraine war happening, is that there's also less critical space even than before to consider these systems, because it kind of, I think there's this perception, right, anything that kind of helps in countering the Russian invasion is in and of itself positive, right? I can understand the sentiment, right? But I also think that we should be careful about the technologies that we are pushing out and we are normalizing in the process.
Right, and the bottom line is it simply might not work the way we intended or thought it would work, and therefore in the end it's not going to be of any help in a sense.
And that's actually also a good point, you know, like if you think about civilian AI systems, there's so many systems that are just dysfunctional, right? So that actually don't function the way that they were intended, right? Whereas in the military sphere, there still seems to be this really big discourse or narrative about AI being functional, right, and being efficient, right, and being that much better than humans, right? I think the two don't align at all, right? But we already see in other areas of applications of AI that actually dysfunctionality is the norm, right? Rather than functionality, it seems.
Right, kind of bringing airline level dysfunctionality to an entirely new domain. Medlier, did you have?
No, I just think that this has been a fascinating conversation, and I want to thank Dr. Baudet for everything. This has been, for me at least, a wonderful, I think, review of some of these discussions on regulation. And of course, you got the Russia-Ukraine conflict looming large behind us. And this obviously plays into a lot of our what we're thinking through this. Well, thank you again so much for this conversation. And of course, thank you to our listeners for joining us today. Of course, as in the past, if you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and leave us a comment. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at onair_podcast. And don't forget to join us for the next episode for a discussion at the intersection of AI and IR theory, law, and practice. Until then, stay human.